Rewind, your week in review is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.
This program is brought to you from Wisconsin Eye's Margaret Farrow Studio.
This week on Rewind, your week in review, a new audit of Milwaukee Public Schools painted a picture of organized chaos and a culture of fear within the state's largest school district. Plus, a liberal justice on the state Supreme Court rejects Republicans' calls to step off a case seeking to restore collective bargaining rights. And we look ahead to what we can expect during Tuesday's primary election, which also falls on the same night Governor Tony Evers is set to unveil his state budget. All that and more on Rewind, your week in review for February 14th.
Hi, I'm Emily Fannin.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
This week, we're going to begin with a new audit that came out this week by the Evers administration examining Milwaukee Public Schools. And this comes in lieu of their big financial mess after they failed to report financial records to the Department of Public Instruction and a series of other problems that have been hovering over the district over the last several months. Looking at this audit, we're just going to start with some of the key takeaways here. Some of the ones that we found out is that, quote, there was a culture of fear and reluctance to change within the board. There was also a lot of overlapping jobs. They made considerations and recommendations to start consolidating some of those. Overall, there was a push to overhaul Human Resource Office. And the audit also suggested that board members overall need a better understanding of their jobs and how to work with MPS administrators. They also kind of stopped short of having people be fired from the board, but they more encouraged people to fill vacant positions and to hire a new superintendent, which actually happened earlier this week. Now, I did talk to some lawmakers who serve on the education committees at the state capitol just about their initial thoughts about what they thought about this audit, which did have some, you know, bombshell recommendations and findings in them. Let's first just take a listen to some Republicans and Democrats responding to this audit before we dive deeper into it.
What came out of the report, I think those are good recommendations. You know, overall, you know, I'm happy with that. The thing is, though, Milwaukee has to want to change. That school district, they need strong leadership that is really going to implement those, because we can't run the district for them. No matter, we can make all the recommendations in the world, but if they don't buy into it and have strong leadership, nothing's going to change.
And I think this, having this in hand, to be able to say, here's a charge, to be able to say, look, there's an outside body that went through and looked at how MPS is operating, and here's a good idea of where to start. I think that combined, within 24 hours of us having a new superintendent, is a powerful formula to actually fixing what the underlying problems are.
Also, just looking at the price tag real quick, there was $5 million allocated by the governor to get this audit up and running. This is its initial findings. We also learned that he wants to propose additional $5 million to further examine MPS. And some of that money, too, this one audit was roughly about $2 million. The rest of the money would go to MPS to start implementing some of these recommendations that they issued.
So the two big questions are, one, will MPS embrace what's being proposed here? And two, will lawmakers approve the other $5 million Evers wants to do? Remember, look at MPS's history. The school choice program was founded in the 90s. It was billed as a way to force MPS to compete for kids, that if families had another choice, MPS would have to improve. That didn't happen. In the aughts, Jim Doyle tried to have a mayoral takeover with Tom Barrett because the district was failing. That didn't happen. In the teens, Scott Walker tried to get a county executive takeover. That didn't happen. And each time there's been a lack of local buy-in to these proposals from the state to try and improve the district. So will this finally change? To be determined. Two, Evers does have some money to play with that paid for these audits. The first one came out this week. The other one's coming about, you know, actually the performance in the classroom, educational stuff. A little bit of money, seed money for this. But the $5 million in the budget, will lawmakers embrace that? Because MPS just approved a referendum, remember, last year, without telling taxpayers about all the money that are the reports they had not turned in to the state. So I'm not sure there's a lot of trust the Republican lawmakers toward MPS. Finally, there's a DPI race on Tuesday, primary, three-way primary. This is going to be an issue going forward in that race because already Jeff Wright and Brett DeKinzer tried to say, listen, DPI is screwing up here, essentially. John Jagler, Republican Senate Education Chair, did the radio address this week for Republicans, talked about DPI must step in. It has to do something here to help fix this situation. Can they find a solution from the state that the locals buy into?
Right, and it's a multi-pronged approach, right? And like you said, fair point, MPS has to want to do some of these changes. Now, of course, a lot of that is going to rely on this new superintendent from the Boston area if she's going to, you know, pushed to do these things. She was encouraged to go on listening tours and others of recommendations for new leadership. But, you know, people on the ground talking to people at MPS, parents are fed up, especially if you've had a few kids in the district over, say, 10, 15 year span. You're probably like, well, okay, this is great. Another scathing report. Now what? There's also a big question on school funding with MPS as well, because it was a few months ago when I talked to Assembly Speaker Robin Voss. He said, hey, if they don't get their ducks in a row, if they don't put SROs, school resource officers, back in schools, which is still an issue right now at MPS, they're not going to get a funding increase. Now, that is often what we hear from the speaker when he's not, you know, impressed with what's going on. And by Republican lawmakers, a lot of them really point the finger at MPS over many, many years. But it is a multi-pronged approach to see these changes. And whether we do is going to be a big question ahead, especially this additional audit, too, and what it finds.
Education advocates will tell you, like, look, there are also challenges in Milwaukee. Let's
right.
be honest,
oh, yeah.
right? High poverty. Let's talk about lead, lead paint. Lead pipes, I mean, like, their impact for kids who ingest lead, like, there are lots of challenges that you can't fix with state funding. But is there a path forward for them to try and improve things with this audit? We'll see.
All right, and staying on the topic of education, next week we're going to see our first package of education-related bills on the Assembly floor when they are back in session on Wednesday. And this week, of course, a lot of those bills were exec'd out of committee, and we also held some public hearings on others. We're just going to highlight a few of them that were voted out of committee by Republicans, starting with Assembly Bill 1. That would overchange changes that DPI made to benchmarks for standardized testing. Of course, you know, this bill would revert back to the old standards, which critics have argued makes it basically impossible to change or to look at academic performance from year to year after DPI changed some of the wording around academic performance. AB 2, another bill, would force school districts to implement a cell phone ban. Worth noting that DPI did a study that about 90% of school districts already have these in place, but you hear from Representative Kitchens, a co-sponsor of the bill, say, well, this is about enforcing it. There's still kids that have cell phones in there, and some teachers are not enforcing it. AB 3, require recursive writing in the classroom. AB 4, require civics instructions in elementary and high schools. You know, going back to the bill about cell phone ban, that was a key argument that Democrats and Republicans kind of went back and forth with. Why is this needed? If most schools already have a cell phone ban policy, why should we go forth and put another mandate on our school districts? So let's just hear some debate on that bill before we move forward.
This bill coming is going to create, I think, quite a bit of confusion and actually more complication for teachers, for parents. If we're just going to be muddying the waters with this, and the problem is already being dealt with by school boards, why don't we trust those local electeds, right? Why are we challenging their authority, bringing confusion to this?
This is totally not about us not trusting the school districts. Absolutely, they all have policies. But if you look at the enforcement, it's not there. But we're not muddying the water. This is their decision, and it's about enforcement. So that when the parents come into to the superintendent and say, you know, I think my kid needs their cell phone, they can say, I'm sorry, it's state law. They can't have their cell phone in the classroom.
As I mentioned, we'll see votes on Wednesday. You know, given Republicans control the chamber, they're likely to pass. Almost all of these bills that we talked about, besides AB 1, have been either introduced before or vetoed by Governor Evers. I think there's the big question mark over the bill that would revert changes to the standardized test scores, because Evers was the one of a few Democrats that have criticized the move by DPI. Now, whether he will sign that bill is a big question mark, but that's something to keep an eye out for in the coming weeks.
Pulling back the 30,000-foot view of the legislature right now, it's not doing a whole lot. So the assembly will be in for the first time on the floor since passing a constitutional amendment to require voter ID. That will go to referendum in April. The Senate was going to meet next week. It canceled the floor period. At the time, there were four things in Senate Org, which is the committee that schedules a floor action. They're all joint resolutions. There wasn't a single bill passed out of committee as of Wednesday this week to even take up. Now, there's been one added since then. But it shows you the slow pace they're going at right now, legislature. There are a couple reasons for that. One, Republicans are trying to figure out the new dynamic with, you know, smaller majorities in both houses. the Supreme Court of Wisconsin to issue rulings about their authority, basically with rules, the governor's 400-year veto. They want to know what's the environment like. Third, there's a Supreme Court race in April that could change the dynamic of the court and maybe change the chance their bills will survive or policies will survive a legal challenge. So there's lots of stuff going on. They're just not getting stuff done. And there's a thing called the Rule of 50 and Rule of 17. It basically is this rule that's not always enforced, but it says if you're going to pass something in the Senate, you should have 17 Republican votes to get it without requiring any Democrats. And in the Assembly, 50 Republican votes. Well, this week, ROFR, right of first refusal. It's a big utility bill. It was heavily lobbied bill last session. If you're going to get that bill done, you're probably not going to be able to stick to those rules. So I'm watching going forward as, one, how productive they are, and two, will they keep a strict enforcement of that rule of 50, rule of 17, or will Robin Voss, the Speaker, and Devin Lemon, the Majority Leader, the Senate, say, I got to get this done and this done, this done. I can't have three members holding me up.
Right, and we got the budget address next week, so that will pick things up a little bit more. But I will agree with you. I mean, it's just a different dynamic because usually we have, you know, dozens of public hearings, a lot of bills being exact, a lot more floor action, but it's just a different pace for sure this year compared to years past. All right, moving on to the state Supreme Court and some news this week after Liberal Justice Janet Protasiewicz rejected Republicans' calls to recuse herself from the controversial case known as Act 10, as there is a case right now pending in the lower courts that seeks to restore union rights for tens of thousands of state workers. Now, Republicans called on Protasiewicz to step aside after she took part in protests opposing Act 10, and she called a recall petition against former Republican Governor Scott Walker, who, of course, signed the landmark law 14 years ago. Protasiewicz also was criticized for her comments on the campaign trails, believing that Act 10 was unconstitutional, but she stopped short of actually saying she would recuse herself from the case. She said she would consider it. In a motion that she filed to the court, her quote was, "I am confident that I can be, in fact, and appear impartial on this case."
So talking to people after her decision, wasn't surprised legal experts because, as we talked before, I've yet to meet a judge or justice who thinks I'm too biased to hear something. Now, Brian Hagedorn, a conservative in the court, stepped off the case, saying basically, I helped author this law while working for Scott Walker's legal counsel. I defended it. I can't then sit in judgment of it. It gave Protasiewicz cover if she wanted to step off the case because you still have a liberal majority, no matter what, if it were to hear it right now. That's been pushed aside. Will there be any repercussions for Protasiewicz? Probably not. One, she wouldn't be up again until 2033. Two, she said, I'm going to serve one term, so will voters care come then? Maybe not. Two, there is a theoretical thing where Republican lawmakers could get a decision from the court in the Act 10 case and go to the U.S. Supreme Court and say, look, Protasiewicz should not have heard this case. She violated judicial standards. You guys should step in. That's a long shot, probably. What I would look at, though, real quick is what this means because the court the same day also said we're not going to take the case. We're not going to get a decision probably from the Second Court of Appeals for a long time. There are reports filed every year from the appeals courts that show how long it takes to decide a case from notice of appeal to resolution, a three-judge panel. It's about 530 days, the Second District Court of Appeals, which isn't the worst one, by the way. It's actually the third worst. Others take longer. Count out 530 days. That's in the middle of 2026. Best, if it's average. If they take oral arguments, which are not always happen in appeals court cases, it could delay even longer. This could be an issue in the April election because you could argue that the winner could really decide Act 10.
Yeah.
You could also argue next spring when Rebecca Bradley's up, that race could decide Act 10. And there's an outside chance in 2027 that race could decide Act 10. So we'll see how long this takes to actually get through the courts, but don't expect a decision anytime soon. And then two, keep in mind that if things stay as is, if Schimmel were to win in April, okay, Hagedorn's off the case, you'd then have a 3-3 tie between conservatives and liberals. The cases for the Second Court of Appeals in Waukesha, a conservative court. In theory, again, in theory, if that remains, the Second District would be the ultimate arbiter of the decision because nobody could review their decision. If there's a tie to the Supreme Court, that decision would stand, and they would be the ones deciding whether Act 10 lives or dies in Wisconsin. So long story looking forward, but don't expect resolution anytime soon. This is going to take a while.
Right, and it's going to be a key issue, like you mentioned, in the state Supreme Court race on April 1st. All right, let's move on to more federal issues impacting the state here in Wisconsin. A lot of that has to do with UW research and funding, which could be in limbo. But we want to talk about, of course, that was a move after we found out that the National Institute of Health funding may be making some cuts. It's now part of a legal challenge, so those cuts were put on hold. But then we also heard from Assembly Speaker Robin Boss this week that he said there's no plans to kind of basically fill that funding gap at the University of Wisconsin-Madison to address a potential $65 million loss if the Trump administration ultimately decides to cut research funding. So Voss told the Daily Cardinal earlier this week at an event that the decision to cut the National Institute of Health funding might be a little painful in the short term, but called it beneficial in the long term. So again, this is all ifs, ands, and buts, but it is something that is going to be a big concern for the UW-Madison campus, which is one of the top in the nation that does research funding across the world.
So this is a cap on administrative costs. Now you kind of wonder why there's so much administrative costs. Well, because these things don't happen in a vacuum. You have to have infrastructure, a lab, you have to have equipment, right? So if you're taking that money or capping the amount of money you can have for the infrastructure, you're impacting other research. You hire part-time people or temporary people to come in and work on these grants. There are things like that that this is going to be a hole for UW to fill. Look at the budget in general. Evers wants to do the $850 million that UW proposed for the entire system. That ain't going to happen. Mm-hmm. They're not going to backfill this. There's not help coming from the Republican-controlled legislature anytime soon for UW with these cuts if they stay in place.
Right, and we often hear from Voss, too, that he's not a big fan of federal funding and filling that with state aid because it's usually a big pot of money, right? The state, the state surplus right now is something that they are proud of. They're not going to try to use that to fill something that the federal government often fills. Also, just from the researchers that I've talked to, too, their biggest concern is, you know, when you really, you know, look out at their work that they do, it's over years at a time. And if you just stop funding a project that's been going on for 10 years, it's not just you lose all of that. Mm-hmm. Because if you start something, you can't just halted it, you know, right in the beginning. So that's their biggest concern, too. It's not like something you can pick up in another few years because they usually obviously have metrics and data that they're keeping a close tabs on. All right, moving on to our next topic is bringing up Eric Hovde. Why? Because he's raising questions again about his November defeat. In a 3-minute video that he posted on X, Eric Hovde vowed to start speaking out about election integrity, saying that some people believe that he may have been robbed in his loss to Democratic Senator Tammy Baldwin. Also in the video, Hovde raised a series of claims about the November election that have been debunked by a series of election officials. My biggest question here, JR, is why are you doing this? Do you want to just be an election integrity guy in the future? Is this maybe a platform to run again? Who knows?
That's the question. If Eric Hovde wants to just bring up quote unquote election integrity stuff, okay. You know, there's an appetite for some Republicans out there to talk about this stuff. If he wants to run for office again, you're already the sore loser who took 2 weeks to concede to Tammy Baldwin. Now you're going to spend weeks and possibly months bringing up debunked claims about your election loss. Let's go over some of them. Thomas Leaguer, he's still unhappy that his America First candidate was on the ballot and blamed him for his loss. If Thomas Leaguer wasn't on the ballot and Eric Hovde got every single vote that was cast for Thomas Leaguer, he still lost to Baldwin. Now, we have like 30 votes. They still would have lost. And you cannot project all those votes for Leaguer to Hovde. There's a reason they didn't vote for him. There's no doubt that Donald Trump endorsed Eric Hovde. They campaigned together. There was something about him those voters didn't care for. There's that. Two, Tammy Baldwin. He said in the video she got 85% of the 120,000 absentee ballots cast in Milwaukee. Little off, it was 82%, about 108,000 absentee ballots. She won 75% of the vote in Milwaukee on Election Day. Look, big picture, Democrats tend to vote more absentee than Republicans do. Joe Hendrick, a longtime GOP consultant on redistricting, predicted the swing that we saw from the absentee ballot count out of Milwaukee in favor of Baldwin and Harris. Three, why would Democrats cheat to beat Eric Hovde but not cheat enough to beat Donald Trump? That's a question Hovde has yet to answer in any logical way that people I talk to can't get past. Now, again, if he wants to bring election integrity stuff up, okay, there are people who have an appetite for that Republican base. If you want to run, though, what's this going to help you, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, after he lost, people really talked about, well, he's a candidate for governor in 26 because he came in the whisker of Tammy Baldwin, became a better candidate as the campaign went on, and he wrote a $20 check to run his campaign. I mean, he has some attractive attributes. But do you want to write that check again in a year and a half? Maybe, maybe not. Two, Hovde told me in 2022 he passed on running for governor then because his wheelhouse, his issues he cared about were the federal level. He wasn't really interested in state stuff. So I'm not sure he's that interested in it. But this, if you're going to really spend the next few months doing this stuff, people are not going to help you. Now, Donald Trump, he made claims about the election for 4 years. Didn't bother him at all.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Eric Hovde's not Donald Trump. Donald Trump, his base amplified and embraced those claims. You're not hearing Republicans rush to embrace Eric Hovde's claims and amplify them in a way that happened with Donald Trump.
And a lot of those election claims are getting quieter and quieter and quieter. Why? Because President Trump is back in office. So that's also another thing. If you're going to still be on this drumbeat, who's going to follow along? Of course, yes, there's many people who are still denying what happened in 2020 and still have real questions about what happened back 4 years ago. But it is just getting quieter about that issue. All right, let's move on to looking ahead to Tuesday, why it's going to be a busy day. For one, it's going to be the primary election for state superintendent. Of course, you see the three candidates on your screen, Jeff Wright, Brittany Kinzer, and incumbent Jill Underly, who is the state superintendent of schools. Meanwhile, in the background, we'll be here at the state capitol covering Governor Tony Evers' budget address. Of course, that will be at 7 p.m., and it will be streaming here on WizEye for folks who want to watch at home. So a lot going on here. We're going to get more into the fundraising efforts, looking at the state Supreme Court race in stock picks in just a little bit. But let's first start with Governor Tony Evers. Obviously, we know a lot of the themes, education, Medicaid expansion, health care, aid for farmers, clean water, some of the similar things that he's talked about over the last several years. What's new? What are the surprises? If any, that's what I'm looking for.
What's his tax cut going to be? What's his education number? Underly wanted $4 billion for DPI. The governor said that's too much. So what's going to be his happy place for education? And little side note, remember his veto from last budget guaranteed schools an increase of $325 per kid what they can spend each year between state aid and property taxes. He said it's not enough. So what's going to be his number to increase spending per pupil per year going forward? Be an interesting thing to see.
All right, and it's going to be interesting to see who advances out of the DPI race, because that race will narrow down to two. All right, let's move on to stock picks this week. We're first, before we get to some of the candidates in the DPI race, we're going to start with Rising, which is Susan Crawford.
So fundraising numbers this week, Susan Crawford outraised Brad Schimmel in the pre-primary period, which was January 1st, February 3rd, about $4.5 million, about $2.3 million, I think it was. Part of that was because she got $2 million from the state Democratic Party. He got $1.675 million from the Republican Party. She's eked ahead of him in terms of spending on the air the last 2 weeks, about even overall for the race, but she's spending more right now. And the state Democratic Party has a deeper pocket right now than the Republicans do to put more money into the race. Now, there's some good sides for Schimmel, too. One, Republicans have picked up the pace fundraising. He's doing way better than Daniel Kelly was at this point 3 years ago, or 2 years ago, I'm sorry. Like, it's not even close. Two, we just saw last night that Fair Courts America, a conservative group, is laying down an ad buy, about $1.1 million so far, starts end of February through the April 1st election. So the cavalry is coming. For Schimmel, though, people, I mean, he has to keep it close financially until early March. He can't get blown out in the next few weeks because if he can show it's close, he can then get Nashville to invest in this race and perhaps over, you know, outspend Crawford. They feel like on the Crawford side, they have Schimmel in a good spot. He's talking about abortion a lot, those kinds of things. They also feel like the Brad Schimmel you get on shows like Upfront or mainstream media is different than the Brad Schimmel you get on talk radio or on these conservative groups and he goes and talks to them. They're going to try to highlight in the next few weeks, next month, that Brad Schimmel behind closed doors talks a different way than he does to people like us, that he is quote-unquote extreme. Meanwhile, Republicans are hammering Crawford about this fundraising email that went out. It pitched a call with her suggesting that, you know, this race has a chance to flip two congressional seats. That's their entree to national people. Say, hey, you guys should be paying attention to this. And looking at Schimmel's report, I saw Jim Jordan from Ohio, congressman, give money to Schimmel. That's a sign he's getting some attention. Tom Tiffany, Wisconsin congressman, obviously. And then also a guy from Oregon. So they're starting to say, okay, I see a reason to be invested here. The question is, will they really get involved? And how's that race going to look financially over the next 6 weeks, roughly?
Left. All right. Staying on the topic of fundraising, we're looking at the state Republican Party here in Wisconsin.
If you had told me a decade ago when Republicans wrote campaign finance laws, that Democrats have more millionaires and billionaires, want to write big checks to the party, I would have said you're crazy. But it has played out over and over and over again. Look at the latest reports. Again, Democratic Party of Wisconsin outraised Republican Party. They have bigger checks. George Soros, $1 million. Reid Hoffman, $250,000. J.B. Pritzker, Illinois governor, $500,000. Now, the Republicans, they had the usual suspects. Dan Hendricks, who has $975,000. Liz Uline, $650,000. They're businesswomen, one Diane from Beloit, Liz from Illinois. They're always involved in Republican races. But Ricketts, Joe Ricketts, he's a founder of TDA America. He gave $500,000. That's noteworthy because he was a donor to Scott Walker a decade ago. In fact, he gave money to Walker in the recall process back in 2012. He last gave anything in Wisconsin, from what I could find out in the campaign finance reports, in 2018 for Walker's reelection bid. If you can get more millionaires out of state to invest, you can maybe match what Democrats are doing. Now, Republicans had hoped that Ben Wickler running for national chair would distract him from raising money. Didn't happen. Mm-hmm. So what I'm watching going forward is, are we going to see Republicans really have an uptick in their fundraising from these national big donors? Can they keep pace with Democrats? Because remember, you can make limited transfers from a party to a candidate. Candidates then get a better rate when they can buy TV ads for. The more you funnel to Crawford and Schimmel, the longer, farther your dollar goes for buying TV ads, and those drive the narrative, right, in spring in the races. So something to watch.
All right. And failing this week is Jill Underly, because she's being outraised by some of her opponents in the race.
Look, if she gets through on Tuesday, it's not because of what she raised. She's raised 170 grand going back to like July 1st, I think it is. 106,000 from the state Democratic Party. That's 61% of your money raised. Now, raising more DPI raises is not easy. Okay, don't get me wrong. But you're the incumbent. Like, what are you doing that you can't raise more money? If you take out the state Democratic Party money, she's not raising more than Jeff Wright is at this point in the process. Now, Brittany Kinzer, who told me she was a blue dog Democrat and went to the Democratic National Convention last summer, raised basically $500,000 between the pre-primary report and late contributions. It is a who's who of GOP donors. Liz and Dick Uline. The state Republican Party gave her $200,000. Like, these are Republican donors and school choice folks. So if you are funded by Republicans and they're putting all your hopes into you, are you still a Democrat or a moderate as you run? Conservatives tell me that all she's promising is to take politics out of the classroom, focus on reading, writing, arithmetic, that kind of stuff. And they just want her as an alternative to Underly.
Right.
Now, my question is, if Underly gets through, and both will bet Underly and Kinzer will get through, Wright's got a shot. It's a low turnout primary. Who's going to vote on Tuesday?
I know, yeah.
But if Wright and if it's Underly and Kinzer, the thought is the kind of progressive hemisphere will coalesce around Underly, right? The Democratic Party gave her like $900,000 4 years ago when she ran. They'll come in to help her out. But she is not really popping fundraising-wise, and money makes the world go around. Now, for Kinzer, will more money come, because the Supreme Court race is, that's the everything.
Yeah, that's the top of the ticket. Mm-hmm.
So if you're a Republican donor, all right, you've tapped out to her. Are you going to give more, expecting to go to her, like give the party money to help it goes to her? That's a big question for her, but she's got an impressive number so far, and Underly is not.
Right, and does her message change if she gets through the primary as well, right? She's on the campaign trail with people like Brad Schimmel, obviously the conservative in the state Supreme Court race, but even at the last public event that she had, hosted by WizPolitics, the forum, she was so careful to avoid that question of what she wants her label to be. Are you conservative? Are you liberal? Well, I don't want to say anything. I don't want to step too far, but that's something I'm watching for. Does that change if you want to get some more money and some more traction down the road? We'll see. All right, that will do it for this week. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Emily Fannin.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
We'll see you next week.
This program was brought to you from the Margaret Farrow Studio.
Rewind, your week in review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.